This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 126, Fresh Ears in the Morning. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Mike Schindler. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Star Trek's nomination for an Art Directors Guild Award, political resignations in Klingon, the fan choice for Best Star Trek Film Guest, and we remember Joseph Ruskin, James Avery, and Marty Hornstein. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart and special guest Mark Cushman to go behind the scenes of A Mock Time. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Mike. It's good to have you with me this week as we come back from the holidays. And what was actually the longest break the Ready Room has ever taken, but it was a much needed break to get through everything that was going on there at the end of the year. But I'm glad we're back here now to talk about Star Trek. And how's the year starting off for you?
So far, so good. I just watched the Golden Globes. I always find it fascinating what 80 gossip columnists have to say about the world of movies. So that was interesting. And
I thought you were going to say I just watched The Golden Girls.
No.
And then I was picturing that episode of Alf where they took the TV away from him and he put the little dolls up on the clothesline and he's shaking them.
Yeah.
I asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm watching The Golden Girls."
Yeah, I don't watch The Golden Girls, although I was a fan of The Golden Palace back when it was on. The spin-off series. That was pretty great.
I don't remember that one.
That was the one where I think B. Arthur left. One of them left.
Yeah.
But then the rest of them went to run a hotel.
I remember that. Yeah. I didn't remember the name, but yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
It was better than the Ropers spinoff from Three's Company, right? Where the Ropers move out to the suburbs somewhere.
What was that one called? Was that called?
I think it was called The Ropers, wasn't it?
Oh, okay. All right. I guess so.
Really creative, you know, at that point in time. But what about also, I have to ask you, I know people probably don't want to hear about this weather stuff, but I've just been kind of astonished at the temperature readings there from your area in the United States, because it's been cold here, but nothing like there. I mean, what do you do when it's like that?
When it's negative 17 degrees? You go outside and you see if your car will start. And if it does, then you start it and you let it run for like 10 minutes and then you go back in the house and then come back out the next day and hope that it starts again. And if it does, then you go to work, which is completely pointless because no one's there. But whatever. Yeah. It really wasn't that tremendously bad. I just stayed inside. And then like the next day, I was worried about the next day because they were showing Back to the Future at a theater down the street. And I really wanted to see that. But the temperature got up to 2. So I was like, all right, this is like a heat wave.
Heat wave.
Let's do this, you know?
I thought maybe you ran outside and you reenacted all of Harry and Chakotay's scenes from Timeless on Voyager. Because you get that perfect icy landscape and...
No, too cold, too cold. I was thinking about doing the Rura Penthe thing, but... Because it really was like that. And then, of course, you know, 3 days later, temperatures heated up to 40 degrees, torrential downpours, all the snow was melting, and we had massive flooding everywhere. So that was fun, too.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the news of Star Trek and what happened during the break. And unfortunately, you know, you take a long break from the show, as we did, and several people passed away from the Star Trek family during that time. And Mike, you know, they say that celebrities die in threes, and unfortunately, that's kind of what happened to us during the break, because we lost three people. Yeah. We lost Joseph Ruskin. We lost James Avery, who we just talked about on the last Ready Room before the holiday break, and also producer Marty Hornstein.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, Joseph Ruskin, he was in a million episodes of the show, wasn't he? I mean, even if you don't...
He was. I don't think people realize how many roles he had in Star Trek.
I didn't, you know? But it's kind of insane. He was in Gamesters of Triskelion in the original series. And then a couple of episodes of Deep Space Nine. Insurrection? It's crazy.
Yeah, I think... For me, when I visualize who he is, the person I think of is Galt from Gamesters of Triskelion, you know, with the red, it's sort of like vampire garb, I guess, yeah. Kind of how I always thought of it anyway, the crazy costumes that episode, but sort of like the games master there. And as you said, yeah, House of Quark looking for Parlock in all the wrong places. He played Tumek. He played the Cardassian informant in Improbable Cause, the Sona officer, or one of the Sona officers in Insurrection. The Vulcan Master in Gravity on Voyager, and also Suliban Doctor on Broken Bow. So this is interesting to me when you think about who the guest actors are, because we like to always talk about Jeffrey Combs here on The Ready Room.
He is everywhere.
And of course, Majel Barrett was in the most things as the computer voice, but Ruskin is actually, he's one of only five actors to appear in both TOS and Enterprise. There were some nice crossovers there, but he's also one of only four actors, I believe it is, who there's Majel Barrett doing the computer voice, Clint Howard, Jack Donner, Vince Diedrich, who also appeared in both of those. But Ruskin appeared, with the exception of The Next Generation, he actually appeared in every television series on Star Trek, plus Insurrection, so that gives him a film there as well. I don't think he was in the animated series.
Well, but I mean, I would count Insurrection as part of Next Gen. So then you could say, is true. He the only person to appear in all five series?
Maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's amazing all the things that he was in. But he passed away on December 28th of natural causes at the UCLA Medical Center. He was 89, so he lived a very long life, a very full life. And, you know, he did a lot of other projects over the years outside of Star Trek, and a lot of them with other actors from Star Trek. There's The Magnificent Seven, The Twilight Zone, the episode To Serve Man. I'm sure you're familiar with this episode, right, Mike?
Yep, it's one of my favorites.
Which is, of course, parodied in Madagascar, when they climb up in the airplane and they find the book and it says To Serve Man on it. And they go, it's a cookbook.
I vaguely remember that.
The thing about Madagascar, I took my kids to see Madagascar in the theater, and I was thinking, like, you know, the movie's kind of okay. It's animation-wise, you know, it's not quite up to snuff with what Pixar was doing at the time. But the jokes in it were so much for people my age who would get the jokes that would just go completely over the heads of all the kids who were there to see the movie.
Yeah, that movie did not work for me at all. And then I had to watch the sequel. That was even worse. But what can you do?
Yeah. Well, he was also in The Outer Limits, Time Tunnel, Streets of San Francisco, Planet of the Apes, Scorpion King. Lots and lots of work that he did. So sad to see him go. But he lived a very long life and left behind many, many great characters for us in Star Trek. Then James Avery, who I mentioned a minute ago, we were just talking about him on the last Ready Room that we recorded right there before the holiday break towards the end of December. And he passed away on December 31st, which is like 7 days after that episode of the Ready Room dropped.
Yeah, it's too bad. You know, and he, of course, played Uncle Phil on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So yeah. That's probably what most people know him from. But he was the Klingon in one of the Klingons in Affliction and Divergence. So,
yeah, he played K'vaa in those episodes,
and he was also the runner up for Worf, right? Or one of the runners up for Worf.
He was one of the finalists for the role of Worf. Yeah,
which I think I can see as well. The character would have been quite different. I think just the age difference a little bit. Michael Dorn is 61 right now, and James Avery passed away here at 68. So they're pretty close in age. So I could have seen him playing Worf as well, if that's the way they had gone.
It'd be interesting to see if anyone other than Michael Dorn was in there, whether or not they would have chosen to expand that character into one of the leads like they did, you know.
I mean, that's a good point, yeah, because it wasn't a lead character initially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So sad to see him go, and actually shocking to me, just having just talked about Kvar, talked about Affliction and Divergence at that point. It's sad, and so our condolences to James Avery's family, the least behind as well. And the other person that we lost was producer Marty Hornstein, so someone who is behind the scenes, people might not be as familiar with, but played a very important role in the franchise as well.
Yeah, he was the unit production manager and producer in some capacity, either co-producer or executive producer, which is basically, I think, just a title that they give the unit production manager on a number of the movies. He did The Undiscovered Country and then First Contact, Insurrection, and Nemesis. And basically what his job was to kind of like put together the budget and figure out how to make whatever the creators wanted to get up on screen, how to make that happen. And, you know, by all accounts, you know, Rick Berman and everyone says that he was just, you know, a great guy and one of the best in the business. He had a very long career working on tons and tons of different movies and TV shows. And it's sad to see him go as well.
Definitely. And, you know, the kind of work he did is what fascinates me so much about these films and these TV shows. And if you get Blu-rays, DVDs, watch all those extras and listen to these people talk about the craft, because it's a real challenge to take what's in the script and what the script is calling for and you figure out how to get that onto the screen, and especially to do it, say, within the budget. So he's going to be very missed as well, and is like you said, responsible for a lot of the visuals that make The Undiscovered Country, First Contact, Insurrection, and Nemesis work for us.
He's the guy with the pen, you know? That's something that, yeah, that Max always talks about. Like, there's always a guy with a pen, you know? He's the guy with the pen, you know? It's like these directors, they have these great ideas, but they need to go to him to figure out how to do it on budget, you know, and with the resources available, which of course we know from, you know, Star Trek, not nearly as much as you'd think. I mean, Undiscovered Country, that movie was cheap, and it looks like it's way more expensive than it is. So a lot of credit goes to him for that.
Absolutely. So our condolences to the families of everyone who passed away. It's hard. We always remember people from the franchise as they pass away. Usually it's one person that we talk about in a show. So very unfortunate to have three right here to kick off the year. But we can remember them this year by watching the episodes and the movies that they worked on and remembering all the great contributions that they made.
Yep.
So, Mike, on a more positive note here, as we move further into news, word came out that the Art Directors Guild has nominated Scott Chambliss for the Excellence in Production Design for Feature Film Award for 2013. This is in the fantasy film category, which is kind of a strange category, I suppose, to have Star Trek Into Darkness in, but that is the category, and Chambliss is nominated for his work on Into Darkness.
Yeah, which I think is very well deserved. I really like the production design in Into Darkness. You know, I know a lot of purists will complain about the look of the Enterprise and whatnot, but I think it's a really hard job trying to, you know, balance that, you know, the look of the old show with something which makes sense for a modern motion picture. And I think they did a really good job with that. Not to mention, you know, all of the stuff that you have on Earth and Kronos and all that stuff. I thought that Scott Chambliss did a really good job. I've always liked his work. I liked it back on Mission Impossible 3 and all the way up through this, and it's well deserved.
Yeah, I agree. I just got, finally, my Star Trek Into Darkness steelbook. The movie just came out in Japan, believe it or not, last week. It was last Tuesday. Came out on home video in Japan. And I had pre-ordered the steelbook after canceling my U.S. Blu-ray order when it came out because of the whole extras fiasco. Because I knew that the Japanese steelbook would have everything except maybe the commentary. And so anyway, I finally got that in. And this weekend I was watching all the special features on it. And they have a really good look at all this design work that he did there on the movie and how they did the corridors and how they brought them together. And it's really beautiful. And again, like you said, you know, yeah, some purists may not like the design of the Enterprise or what it looks like on the inside, but if you just watch it for, this is what the director's wanting. This is the vision. This is what the script's calling for. How are we going to build this? And you see what they built and you see how they did it and how many people come together to make it happen. It's really amazing. It's actually more interesting to me than the movie sometimes to see how all this stuff comes together. And I think with Into Darkness as well, watching all those special features and knowing what went on behind the scenes and especially the work that Scott did here makes me like that movie a little bit more, because when I watch it, I'm really looking at all the fine details and all the touches that they put into it.
Yeah. I mean, you can complain about the writing or whatever, but there's no denying that that movie has exceptional attention to detail, you know, and everything about it is so well thought out from a production standpoint that you really do see the money up on the screen. You know.
Have you watched the special features from the Into Darkness Blu-rays?
I've listened to the commentary, and that's pretty much it. I usually don't watch special features unless it's something really cool.
Well, there's this one where they show how they turn the Enterprise bridge into the bridge of the Vengeance.
Oh, really? Oh, that's cool.
And make it look like a different ship, but they're going to use the same set. And of course, one thing they did was the classic good versus bad in terms of applying a visual color to it. Like, think back to the Mad Magazine Spy versus Spy, right? You have the completely white spy, you have the completely black spy. It's very, very simple, right? Just a visual cue. And so with the Vengeance being all black, they show how they took all the panels, everything they did for the bridge that was, everything is so white on the Enterprise bridge in the Abrams verse, and turned it all to black. They spent like 6 weeks painting everything black. They redid the control panel, like the little plastic panels that go over the controls. They had those fitted out in black instead of white. They take the white ones off, put the black ones on. And it's something that, at least for me, I'm sure some people picked up on it, but for me, when I'm watching Into Darkness, when they're on the bridge of the Vengeance, I'm never sitting there thinking, you know, this is the bridge of the Enterprise and it's just black. I was never thinking that. So they really, I think, did a very effective job and a cost-effective job of just taking one set and flipping it. And that it's really interesting to watch.
Yeah, and they also responded to some of the criticisms that people had of the first movie and certain sets that were used for certain certain locations that were used for certain sets or vice versa, and you know, expanded on it. You know, you get to see different parts of the ship and everything, and it's not like any of that stuff is cheap or easy to do. So, props to Scott Chambliss, and I'm pretty sure that he's working on Star Wars Episode 7 now, right? I think.
Oh, maybe so. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I would imagine so, with JJ going over to do that. If I were JJ, I would certainly take him along with me.
Yeah. He gets the job done. He gets nominated for the award.
So,
although one thing about this, and this bothers me. So they've got three categories: fantasy, contemporary, and period piece. And in the fantasy category, which makes sense to me. That's fine, you know, and certainly I think Star Trek, out of those three, would fall into fantasy. But Gravity, But Gravity is in the fantasy category. That's not that's a contemporary film. That's all about, I mean, that couldn't be less fantasy if it tried. I mean, people will complain about some things being inaccurate, but that movie's all about science, not science fiction. That's not fantasy. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that's contemporary. the production, the Art Directors Guild needs to know that we have gone into space, even if we're not doing it now. If anything, it's a period piece. You know?
Oh, Mike, awards competitions are, you never know what you're going to get.
This is true.
Those things anyway, so. Well, they're going to announce the winners on February 8th at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Beverly Hills, and there's going to be a ceremony there, so we'll find out if he wins there. In addition to that, John Schaffner has been nominated for his work on the Big Bang Theory episode, The Bakersfield Expedition, which is the episode where they all dress up like Star Trek characters. Have you seen that? We have not gotten that episode in Japan yet, so I have not seen it.
You know, I only watched the first season of The Big Bang Theory, and mm-hmm. I mean, I guess my takeaway from it was that the sets were really nice. So good job, Big Bang Theory. By the way, Chambliss is not doing Star Wars. He's doing the Brad Bird movie, Tomorrowland. So, sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, JJ will have to find somebody else to spruce up the sets on Star Wars.
Yep.
They'll probably all be done digitally anyway, won't they?
No,
Lucas isn't involved anymore.
Lucas
JJ
is not
will
involved.
Use real settings.
I'm going to use real stuff. Yep.
That's good. I'm glad.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my complaints about the newer Star Wars movies is that I just, you know, I want to see stuff that's real. I don't want everything to be CGI.
But I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. And this next story is kind of interesting here. What happened in North Carolina? Did our colleague Philip Gilfus from Earl Grey get into some trouble, or is this someone else in North Carolina?
He'd probably know. I mean, it sounds like he's he's pretty up on what's going on in the political scene over there. We should probably ask him, but I honestly have no idea what the deal was here. But David Waddle, a councilman in Indian Trail, North Carolina, turned in his resignation, and he turned it in Klingon.
Yeah, you know, and I was just thinking that, you know, recently J.G. Hertzler got elected to that city council in New York, and now we've got this guy resigning in Klingon. Is there something we should know about here? Is there a Klingon invasion going on?
It's quite possible, you know. I mean, it would be kind of interesting to see. It would be definitely a change to the political system here in the States, but maybe for the better.
Yeah, I could just see the money. You got a picture of Kayless on there, and Kayless we trust got a batleth on the backside of the money.
Yeah,
it's all red.
Yeah. But you'd have that matte painting from you know, Next Generation of the Capitol. That would be on the back of all the money. Yeah.
That would be cool. Yeah, I would like to see that. And of course, it'd be raining, right? Like in Sins of the Father.
Yep.
On the money.
That would be cool. The counterfeit stuff. It would be the hologram stuff. You'd see the rain.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Nice. I like it. Yeah.
And now I want that.
Instead of the little strip, like off center, you know, they have that little strip that runs through the money. We have that in the Japanese money as well. That would be like, it would be blood embedded in the money itself. And you could do like a DNA test to make sure it's real blood, real Klingon blood.
I like it. Let's do it.
So this was an interesting story, that he resigned. And he gave the council an English translation of his resignation letter.
See, that was the mistake. I mean, you got to make them work for it. If you really want to stick it to them, you got to make them work for it. give them the letter and the Mark Okrand book and just tell them to figure it out for themselves.
You tell them, this Mayor Alvarez, he was apparently not very happy about this. And what you do is you go up to Alvarez and you, like you said, you hand him the letter, you hand him a copy of Mark Okrand's book. And you say, I have something important to tell you, Mr. Mayor. And then you hand him that and you say that I'll be back next week to discuss it. And that's what you do. But apparently the letter read, teach city constitution. I will return next time to victory. Resignation occurs in 2014, the 31st of January. Perhaps today is a good day to resign.
Yeah. Not bad. Not bad.
Not too bad.
Yeah. And yeah, Alvarez, he wasn't too happy about it. He called it an embarrassment. And yeah. He said, when things have a galactic or absurd quote, that's when people pay attention. I would have preferred if he had sent a resignation letter in English to give it to the council, but I wish him luck, live long and prosper. I mean, he's got a point there. I mean, would we be talking about Councilman Waddle's resignation if it weren't for the fact that he had resigned in Klingon? No.
Nope.
So good for him, you know?
At least the mayor got his own little Star Trek twist in there at the end with live long and prosper.
It's kind of weak sauce compared to writing an entire letter in Klingon, though, you know?
Well, at least he didn't say, may the force be with him.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, one more thing on this. StarTrek.com, they did an article about this, and they asked, what do you think? Was it brilliant or was it unprofessional? And was Mayor Alvarez justified in his response? So I guess you just answered the question of was Alvarez justified in his response. But do you think this falls in the category of brilliant, the category of unprofessional, or just the kind of crazy category?
I mean, I don't see why we need to pigeonhole this. I mean, something can be brilliant and unprofessional, and usually it is. And I think this is one of those cases. It was brilliant and unprofessional.
Right. Well, who was it that a few years back, was it Chad Johnson or was it Terrell Owens? I can't remember who it was, but they hid the cell phone in the padding of the goalposts. And when they scored the touchdown, they pulled the cell phone out and they made a call. See, that was both brilliant and unprofessional.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
It's probably Chad Johnson, right?
I think it was Chad Johnson, I think. Yeah. I believe so. All right. So anyway, we have Klingons being elected to city councils. We have Klingons resigning from city councils. Stay on guard in the U.S. is all I'm saying. There's something going on.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on. We have one more thing that we're going to talk about today in news. This is another StarTrek.com poll, which we like to talk about here on the Ready Room from time to time when they do one that's interesting to us. And this one was about the best film guest star. And they had over 25,000 fans voted on this. They gave you six choices, which is one of the problems. I mean, I know from a technical standpoint, you have to limit the number of choices. But the problem with a lot of these polls is that with 12 movies, how are you going to decide which six guest stars you're going to put on the poll? But they chose six. And what were the results, Mike?
Okay, well, starting at the bottom and working our way up, 5% of the vote was for Kirstie Alley, 6% mm-hmm. for Malcolm McDowell. There was a tie for third place at 11% with Christopher Lloyd and Christopher Plummer. And then number two was Benedict Cumberbatch with 20%. And the winner, with 48% of the vote, Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah. So my first question would be, do you have any problem with Ricardo Montalban finishing first? Because for me, I think that's who I would choose.
I mean, you can't really argue with that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the one thing, that, and especially as far as the nominees are concerned, I mean, Plummer is great in Star Trek VI, and Cumberbatch is great in Into Darkness. But, I mean, Montalban, I mean, he's Khan, right? I guess Cumberbatch is too, spoilers. But, you know, Montalban is Khan, right?
Wait, what's that sound I hear, Mike? Listen closely. Oh, that's the sound of our listeners yelling, no, he's not Khan.
All right, well, they need to get over that because he is. Sorry. I didn't make the movie, you know, but whatever. There is one person who I think is missing. Well, what about you? Out of the nominees, who would you pick?
I think, well, Montalban first. I think he is just the most iconic of all the Star Trek film guest stars. Christopher Plummer, I agree with you, was really fantastic. And Christopher Plummer is, apart from Montalban, for me, is probably the most memorable of the Star Trek guests in the films. Part of it is the time that movie was released, and I was in university, and I remember going to the theater over and over to see that film, and I had just lived in I had just been in the Soviet Union for music right before that movie came out and right before the Soviet Union dissolved. And so I had a connection to the theme of the movie as well. And so in the performance, you know, so Christopher Plummer, Christopher Lloyd never worked for me really as a Star Trek villain. It just didn't work. And so I'm a little bit surprised to see Plummer and Lloyd tied here. It was a really close tie. Plummer did come out on top with a few more votes, but it was like 30 votes difference, something like that. It was really close. Cumberbatch, he did. I think he did a really good job in that the portrayal. First of all, I watch him on Sherlock, so I know how he portrays Sherlock Holmes. I've seen him outside of his acting, just being himself, especially on the extras on Into Darkness Blu-rays. You get to see him being himself a lot more, and so I can see that the acting job that he did in the movie is really, really a very good acting job. Soren, Malcolm McDowell. He's not actually Soren. He's Malcolm McDowell.
He is the Star Trek fan.
That's right. Yeah. He worked pretty well for me. He has one of my favorite lines in the Star Trek films, which is, they say time is the fire in which we burn. So I like him. Kirstie Alley, you know, I kind of feel like she's on here just because she was popular a bit later on with Cheers, and it's Kirstie Alley. What I wanted to ask you was, and not a Savick question, not a who was the better Savick, Kirstie Alley or Robin Curtis, who was the better Vulcan, Kirstie Alley or Kim Cattrall?
Kim Cattrall was the better Vulcan.
Yeah,
I mean, she's amazing in that movie. I would put her before Kirstie Alley, I'd put her at number four. She definitely deserves to be in the poll. But, you know, Star Trek 2 is the go-to and everything like that, you know. It's just, But Kirstie Alley, it's not that she's bad or anything like that, but Kim Cattrall is exceptional.
Yeah, Kim Cattrall was the person who immediately popped into mind for me when I saw who the choices were on here as being someone who should have been a choice on the poll.
She should have been a choice, although for me, I would argue that William Shatner is a guest star in Star Trek Generations, and that he deserves to be on the poll for that, in which case he is number one because he's William Shatner.
Okay, I'll give you that, but I think that considering that he's not the guest star in the first six movies, I guess they couldn't really make him a choice here.
They could have.
If it had been who was the best film guest star in a TNG movie, then they could have done that.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Also, if they had done who was the best guest star on Third Rock from the Sun, then they could have put him in there as well. Of course,
they could have done that. Or Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you know? They could have done that too. Or any other show that he's ever been on.
Who's the best guest star on television of all time? And then you could put William Shatner.
Who's the best actor in television of all time? William Shatner. I mean, really, any poll in which, you know, William Shatner is a contender or has done work in that field, best film director of all time, William Shatner. Best recording artist of all time, William Shatner.
William Shatner.
It's just the way it works.
Yeah. Exactly. Who best Priceline pitchman of all time?
I mean, why are we even qualifying this? Best person of all time, William Shatner. Duh.
All right. Well, Mike, I'm going to use this as a transition here to our sponsor spot before we get into the feature today. Our sponsor today is Audible.com, and I'm going to use William Shatner as the transition because the book that I want to recommend today, because in the feature, we're going to be joined by Mark Cushman to go behind the scenes of Amok Time, and we also will talk about other aspects of season two and probably get into season three a little bit as well, knowing how our discussions go. But the book I want to recommend is Star Trek Memories by William Shatner. There are two of them. There's Movie Memories, and then there's just Memories. And I've recommended them on here before, I think. But Star Trek Memories is about the television show itself. And it's one of the best books of all time, Mike. We're talking about William Shatner here. But the Audible version is actually narrated by William Shatner himself. And it is one of my favorite books that takes a look at what it was like to put together the original series.
Yeah, I've actually never read the Star Trek Memories. I've read the movie Memories, and I would say that that's true about that for sure. It really opened my eyes to a lot of things behind the scenes. Whether you know it's all 100% accurate or not doesn't really matter, because it is a wonderful tale regardless. And yeah. I can only imagine that having it read to you by William Shatner himself, I can only imagine how amazing that is. Because his voice is like a velvet, a velvety, smooth something. I don't know what.
Are you trying to say the best voice of all time, Mike?
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, look at his work in the Buzz Lightyear cartoon, yeah. You know, where he sings the song, and I don't think he does a voice in there, but if he did, it would be amazing, right? Osmosis Jones, you know, Over the Hedge, where he plays Avril Lavigne's dad. They're both like, I don't know, what were they, porcupines? I don't know. You have kids.
I think hedgehogs? That sounds right.
Whatever yeah, it is.
Or hedgehogs, maybe. Yeah.
He was amazing. I could totally buy him as a hedgehog.
Best hedgehog of all time.
Yes.
But yeah, the Star Trek Memories book is very interesting. You know, a lot of the information you may have read elsewhere, because it is some of the behind the scenes stuff that a number of different people have shared about what was going on with Gene, what was going on with the studio. But Shatner tells, it's an interesting story about, you know, his life before he got the Star Trek gig, the connections between NASA and Star Trek, and then himself and this event, NASA event that he went to when Star Trek was first launching, and then takes you through, you know, each season of the series and what was going on. And to hear him tell it to you in his own voice is what makes it so great for me, because it's one thing to read the book, but it's another thing to actually have Shatner telling it to you. Because when Shatner reads his books, it doesn't feel like, you know, some audiobooks, someone wrote the book, someone else is going to be the narrator for the book, and they're reading you the book, you know, the way that I read my children bedtime stories or, you know, something like that. You know, that has that feel sometimes. But in this case, it's more like Shatner sitting down with you and he's just telling you what it was like. And so I highly recommend this book, as well as Star Trek Movie Memories. And if you can't get enough Shatner from that, another great Shatner book is Shatner Rules, which came out 1 or 2 years ago, also narrated by Shatner, of course, and fantastic there on Audible.
I have to check that one out. I still haven't read that one.
It's great. It's a great book. So, and the best thing is, as a Trek FM listener, you can choose one of these books absolutely free just for trying Audible. And the way you do that is you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up, and you'll get a trial of Audible. You'll get to choose one audiobook absolutely free. And there's really nothing to lose, because if you decide not to stay with Audible at the end of the trial, you get to keep that free audiobook. That's yours. So you can continue to enjoy that. And, you know, supporting Audible helps us here, because Audible helps support Trek FM and helps us bring the Ready Room and all of our shows to you every week. So go check these out. And also, I should say, you know, if you don't want one of these three books, they have over 150,000 titles there on the site, and they have lots of Star Trek books. They have every category, you know, science, historical, business books, all kinds of things for you to choose from. And another thing, these days, you know, most books that are published, especially hardcover books, they have an audio version that drops at the same time as the hardcover, and almost all of those appear on Audible right when they're released as well. So it's a great way to read all the books that you want to read, but you don't have time to sit down and read because you've got to drive your car, you got to commute, you got to work. Just put them on your phone or your tablet or your computer, and you're good to go. So again, drop by audibletrial.com/trekafilm and sign up today. And we really thank Audible for supporting the Ready Room and the network. One of the most famous afflictions in Star Trek is the Ponfar, also known as the Vulcan 7-Year Itch. And one of the most famous episodes of TOS is the one that introduced us to the Ponfar, Amok Time. Now, we've discussed this episode here on The Ready Room before in our show titled All Roads Lead to Stan, but today we're going to take an inside look at Amok Time with our special guest, author of the new book, These Are the Voyages, Mark Cushman. Mark, welcome to The Ready Room.
Good to be back. Hi, guys.
Good to have you here with us and talk about the book and talk about the episode. And also joining us, of course, is our TOS editor, Landru, and co-host of Standard Orbit. Hello, Landru.
Joy to you, friends.
How's it going there in Indianapolis here? We're coming off the holidays. We haven't recorded in a while.
Yeah, well, it's okay. It's kind of scary outside, like stormy, kind of supposedly blizzardy, but it didn't snow any. I don't know.
Well, that doesn't sound like the will of Landru. Can't you do something about that?
No, unfortunately, I don't have he can't control the weather. That's Val's job.
Oh, all right. We'll talk about that later.
Hey, great segue into what we're going to be talking about. That's right. Val can shoot lightning bolts down and bring storm clouds in. Excellent job.
Yeah, but that's next month, so.
Oh, okay.
We need some time.
A little preview for next month.
That's right, a preview for the next show. All right, well, Mark, I'm going to just pass the ball off to you on this one because we normally discuss episodes here on The Ready Room and we touch on our points, but you have a very interesting inside story to tell us about Amok Time. So why don't you just kick off the discussion here?
Well, you know, Amok Time was the first episode aired for the second season. It was the one the staff and NBC, as they were making it, as they were writing it, said, this is going to be the one. And they even pushed it back to be the fifth episode produced because they wanted to take their time getting everything right. And there was a lot that they had to get right. They had to invent the entire planet Vulcan and the Vulcan language and the costumes and all the rituals and everything else. And NBC was actually very concerned about that. You'll read in These Are the Voyages, Book 2, which will be out, available right around March 1st, that Stan Robertson at NBC was very enthusiastic about this project. But at the same time, he was very concerned about it because he knew the fans during the first year of Star Trek, from the letters that were coming in, were getting very, very interested in Spock and the whole background of Vulcan. And now they were going to take you there. So he said, we have to be very, very careful with this script, and we have to make sure we don't disappoint anybody. And so when you read about this in the chapter on the episode, you'll see a lot of memos back and forth and a lot of letters and communications between the network and Roddenberry and Kuhn and their staff, Bob Justman and Dorothy Fontana, trying to work this episode out and all the details to make sure the fans wouldn't be disappointed. So that's one of the things that makes it a very interesting read. But something else that you'll find out in Book 2 is that they almost didn't have Leonard Nimoy and Mr. Spock for Season 2 of Star Trek. His agent wanted more money for Leonard, and for good reason, because when he signed on to do the series, he was supposed to be a supporting actor. And yet he was getting more fan mail than even William Shatner, who was the star of the show, yet only a fraction of the money. So the agent wanted to get him a big bump, and Desilu, with Star Trek going over budget every single episode and bankrupting the studio, didn't want to give him the money. So they said, no, you're under contract, you have to report to work. And Nimoy's agent said, no, he's not coming. And this went back and forth, and they were just a few weeks out from shooting the second season, and they didn't have Leonard Nimoy locked in, so they had to find another actor who could play the Vulcan on the Enterprise. Not play Mr. Spock, but a different Vulcan. And so they signed an actor to play that part with a guarantee that if, in the last minute, they were able to work out a deal with Nimoy to return to the series, that he would be given a supporting part in one of the episodes. And that supporting part turned out to be in the episode Amok Time.
Who was it?
Oh, gee, dude, maybe I should make you read the book.
Okay, all right.
You can't give it all away on the Ready Room, right?
I'll give you a hint. He's in the episode.
All right. Fair enough.
I'll give you some other fun information. The runner-up, the two guys that were number two and number three on the short list, one was Mark Leonard, because they liked the way he looked in The Vulcan Ears and Balance mm-hmm. of Terror, and they really respected him as an actor. But in the end, they decided he was too old. He was probably 35, and they thought, we got to have somebody younger than that. And another person who almost got the job was David Carradine, who went on to be Mr. Kung Fu in the 1970s in the series Kung Fu. And he lost out at the last minute to the person who was given the contract, but ended up only getting the consolation prize of appearing in Amok Time. You can probably guess.
It's not too hard, I don't imagine.
Who's wearing ears in that episode? Who is the right age? Who might have looked good in a blue shirt on the Enterprise? I'll let your listeners try to figure it out, and then they can read the book and see if they guessed right.
What other kinds of concerns were on those memos that were going back and forth?
Well, you know, first of all, Amok Time was supposed to be done in the first season. It was going to be the second to last episode produced for season one. Theodore Sturgeon, who had written Shore Leave for the First Order of 16, even though it was the 17th episode produced, because he was late delivering his script and they had so much trouble working that out, because Theodore Sturgeon was a famous science fiction author who had never written mm-hmm. for television and didn't know how to write TV scripts. So it took a lot of work to get Shore Leave done. But everybody was very, very happy with the results and very happy with his creativity, but also his name value. And that was a very important thing to Gene Roddenberry, was having Harlan Ellison, Theodore Sturgeon, Jerry Soule, Robert Bloch, Richard Matheson. These were all renowned science fiction authors, and none of them were writing for Lost in Space. So this was a great feather in Gene Roddenberry's cap to have them writing scripts for Star Trek. So when they got their back end pickup for the first season, the back 13, they gave a second assignment to Theodore Sturgeon. But it was like pulling teeth to get a script out of Theodore Sturgeon, because he was used to writing at his own speed for his books and his short stories. And so they were pushing and pushing to try to get him to deliver the script, and he ended up delivering the first half of it. And Bob Justman wrote a wonderful memo saying, "This is brilliant. Am I going to have to wait till next season to see the next half?" And it turned out he did. So they weren't able to get it made for the first season because the script was late. And then when they got it and they started rewriting it, and NBC took such a special interest in this episode, NBC, who didn't want the character of Mr. Spock to begin with, but now suddenly realized what a great asset he was, they wanted everything just to be perfect about this. But Ted Sturgeon created a language. He created the Vulcan language. And you're going to split a gut when you read the memos, especially from Bob Justman, because you know from book one, Bob Justman's memos are delightful. Very bright and great instincts, but he's also very funny, a very sharp, wicked wit. And the words, Spock, Kerflart, and things like that, and he writes his email, I think we're going to have the biggest laugh of the season when T'Pring yells out, "Spock, Kerflart," and he says, "I don't think they're going to be laughing for the right reason."
Right.
So they brought in, they turned to Pete Sloman over at DeForest Research to invent the Vulcan language. I interviewed Pete Sloman for this book, and so I got some wonderful comments from him about Star Trek and working for DeForest Research in conjunction with the producers on Star Trek to try to make everything as close to scientifically possible as he could. And so they really had to work on that language. And Matt Jeffries, who designed the Enterprise inside and out, and every week had to design the new planet they were going to go to, had to come up with the design of what Vulcan was going to look like. And they had to decide, where are we going to shoot this? And they were scouting out near Vasquez Rocks. They were thinking the desert. And Bob Justman finally said, you know, if we do that, we're going to have blue sky. And Vulcan needs to have an angry red sky. So they decided they would have to do it on Stage 9 there at Desilu. And so there were just a lot of decisions that had to be made in the process that you don't think about, us, the viewers. And when you're writing a show like this and decide we're going to take the audience to the planet Vulcan for the first time. So it was really quite a challenge for them to put this one together. But they knew they had a winner, and they wanted to make sure that it was the one that could open up the season.
It's interesting that you say that they had this planned as the opener from the beginning, because there's a lot of debate amongst nerds as to which order these episodes should be watched in, and there are some people who believe they should be in production order. But here is a clear case of, you know, this was supposed to be the first, and I agree that it does work really well as a season opener.
My whole headcanon.
Yeah, I'm one of those nerds who, this is Mark the nerd speaking, I'm one of those nerds who thinks you should watch them in the order that they were produced, because mm-hmm. you see the evolution of Star Trek by doing it that way, not only from the point of view of Roddenberry and his writers, but also from the actors, as the actors are developing the characters and where at what point did Leonard Nimoy come up with the Vulcan nerve pinch, and as you read in book one, it was his idea. And then, of course, Gene came up with the idea of mind meld, because NBC didn't want them trying to hypnotize Van Gelder in Dagger of the Mind, because there was a policy at NBC that you couldn't hypnotize anybody in a TV show, because they were afraid members of the audience might get hypnotized. So Roddenberry said, well, then we have to come up with a way for them to get access to Van Gelder's locked, suppressed memories, and if we can't hypnotize him, I'm going to have Spock do it by laying hands on him. And so that's how they came up with that. So it's really interesting to see how a lot of these things were brought about because they had to work around the rules of broadcast in those days and NBC broadcasts in those days.
Well, at least we know that this NBC policy of no hypnotizing on TV was gone by the 80s, because, Mike, you remember that episode of Alf where Alf tries to hypnotize Lucky and convince him that he's a bagel? So NBC was okay with it 20 years later.
You know, but I'm still a little dazed from watching that episode with Alf. So I don't know. There may be something to it. But I like watching them in the order they were produced. And but sometimes in broadcast, most of the time in broadcast for Star Trek, especially in the first season, the order they showed the episodes wasn't necessarily because, well, this would be the best one to start with. It was more about what's ready.
Yeah,
I mean, they always knew in season one they wanted to open with the Corbinite maneuver. And it was written to be the first episode we would see. It gives us a tour of the entire ship. We even see Kirk go to his cabin to change, and then he goes up in the elevator, and we're looking over his shoulders as the doors open, and we see the bridge as he walks into it from behind him. And it was an episode where they wanted to build a lot of tension on the bridge and introduce the characters through all this conflict of them having this death sentence put on them. Plus, they knew they had great special effects for that episode, things nobody had ever seen before, and so forth. But it took so long to get those special effects done that it ended up being the ninth episode to air. And they started with the Man Trap because NBC said, well, it's a planet show, and it didn't require a lot of shots of the Enterprise, and they were able to get it done fast. But, you know, what Mike was saying is true. For season two, you want to open up with an episode that you can promote and is a one that's really going to grab people's attention. Oh, my God, we're going to the planet Vulcan. Spock has to get married. It's a great episode to promote for the network to say that's going to be our season opener. So that's why they wanted it, for that reason. And but when you're watching these things, it doesn't really matter. You just kind of watch the show as it evolves.
Well, my question now that you can't answer is, why Spock's brain? Why did it open season three?
You know, I will answer that. And it's a fascinating story. You know, my favorite of the three books, all three of them are done, mostly done. I'm in the process of working with proofreaders. We have them this time.
Yay.
We didn't have them. I thought we had them with the first version, but I found out afterwards that we didn't. But we've got four great proofers working with us now to make sure everything's right. Not just as far as me being a TV writer who, like Mark Twain, I say I don't have a lot of respect for somebody who can only spell a word one way. So, but these proofread readers I have now are all great fans of Star Trek. Two of them are college professors, and the other two are authors. And one of them even wrote scripts for a couple of the newer, later Star Trek series. And so they know the show, and they know the characters. And if I get anything wrong, God forbid, I've got them looking over my shoulder and making sure we get it right. And that's why we just put out a revised, expanded edition of book one, not to try to get more money from anybody, but because we listen to people, and everyone said, man, this is a great book, but couldn't you have spent a little more time? It needed one more proofing, or it needed this, or it needed that. And so, you know, we listened to everybody, and we thought, okay, well, this is the first book. Let's really get it, the whole thing launched right, and then go from there. And we've now got this great team with us working on book two. And so we're in the process of getting that one polished up and getting all the pictures put in. And then we'll turn our attention to getting book three finished up. But they're all written. So I can answer your question about Spock's brain. I'm going to be a little vague because I do want you to buy book three and read it. But it's my favorite because it was the most difficult season for them to make. And like when you're watching a movie, it's a three-act structure. And the story gets more and more difficult for the lead character as he's going through it. The challenges become bigger. Otherwise, it's not a very good movie. We lose interest. Well, the Star Trek story works that way too. It gets more difficult as they go along because the time slots kept getting worse. The budget kept getting cut. People were getting burned out. Things were happening. So it was a bigger struggle every time they had to do another episode, every time they had to do another season. And so you get into season three, and there's a lot of struggles going on with that horrible time slot. The budget, less money than they had ever had. A lot of the creative people had left the show because they were just fried and they couldn't continue. And so you had a lot of things that were going wrong, but they were still trying as hard as they possibly could. And Spock's brain, Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn came up with that story together. And they were sitting in the office watching the news because that was a great harvesting ground for them to get stories. And the first heart transplant had just taken place. And it was news every night of the week because people were protesting all around the planet. There were marches and picketing and demonstrations like you can't believe. And it was a huge news story. Does man have the right to take a heart, to play God, to take a heart out of somebody and put it into somebody else? And so the two of them looked at each other, the two genes, and they said, we got to do something with this. But 200 years from now, heart transplant's going to be old news. What would be different? What would be interesting? And that's when one of them thought, brain transplant. Well, in hindsight, we can say, don't do it.
You know? Run.
But if you're in their office in 1968, and the biggest news story going on for weeks is about this heart transplant, And just try to put yourself in their shoes and go back in time, which I try to do in these books, is send the readers back in time. And my God, most people don't even have remote controls for their TVs. There's no cell phones. There's no microwave ovens. There's no DVDs or CDs. These are all things on Star Trek. And so it's a primitive world in many ways. And what giant news it was that they actually took an organ out of one person and put it into another. And that he's still alive, or at least was for a while, and so you gotta do something with that. And so they were always looking for things like that to do their stories about. So that's the genesis of Spock's brain, where it came from, with the absolute best intentions. Now from there, it turned into it kind of spiraled out of control, and it's a very interesting it's a very interesting read. I like writing about. And reading about the episodes that did work, more so than the ones that did. That's probably why book three is my favorite.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, and I can understand that. It makes sense. Mike and Drew, I can't remember if it was you guys or someone else said recently that maybe Spock's brain would have been more interesting if they had metaphorically removed Spock's brain instead of literally removed the organ itself. Like they somehow wiped his mind and they had to go find it, but But that's an interesting story.
Well, think about this, though, guys, and we can talk about this in more detail when book three comes out. It'll be several months from now, so everybody will forget we talked about it now, right? I know I will. But it was really very shocking. And you know, if you watch that episode, I still get chills to a certain extent. And I can remember seeing it for the first time in September 1968 when I was 15. And it's a pretty horrific scene when they wake up on the bridge and Kirk looks over and he says, "Spock, what happened?" And he doesn't get an answer and he looks over and Spock isn't there. And suddenly McCoy's calling saying, "Jim, get down here." You know, and what is it, Bones? He says, "Just get down here." And you see this look in Shatner's face like he knows it has something to do with Spock and it's not good. And a nice little acting touch he did there. And they rush down there. And they say, "Is he dead?" And McCoy says, "No, worse than dead.
Worse than dead.
His brain has been removed, surgically removed from his head." That's pretty horrific, especially in 1968 when everyone's worrying about the first heart transplant. So again, you can see the intent. And there were a lot of good ideas that were being bounced back and forth in the memos where Gene Roddenberry wrote. He said, you know, it would make perfect sense that somebody would want Spock's brain to operate this control system because he has such a fantastic brain and he has such a logical mind and he can multitask and things of that nature. So they had a lot of good ideas going on, but unfortunately it just didn't come together. And you know what they were missing at that point in the third season, and you can see why this episode didn't work and some of the others didn't, is they didn't have, other than Bob Justman, they didn't have anybody on staff who was cynical at that point. You know, Fred Freeberger wasn't really a cynical person, and Gene Roddenberry wasn't a cynical person. He believed in utopia. He was an optimist. But when you read the letters, the memos between Justman and Fontana and Kuhn, especially when they were cooking during the last part of the first season and throughout the second season, the humor between them, if there was anything that the audience might laugh at, these three would pick up on it ahead of time and say, "Okay, we can't do that." You know? So even though Gene Kuhn wrote Spock's brain, or the first couple drafts, he wasn't there for all the rewrites. And I think that stuff would have been cleaned up if it had been Justman, Kuhn, and Fontana finalizing that script. I think it might have worked better.
So going back to Amok Time, obviously this episode, at least I feel as a viewer, benefited from the presence of everyone. It didn't suffer from the things that Spock's brain suffered from. It's definitely a fan favorite, but what else happened after they made the decisions they're going to shoot on stage 9 for Vulcan, so we get to look at the planet. They've got the casting worked out. What happened next in the production with any challenges or such?
Well, yes, because first of all, then they had to decide what will Vulcan look like. And when they finally made the decision it was going to have to be on the stage, they had to design the costumes. They had to design the language. Leonard Nimoy came up with the hand gesture, the salute for Live Long and Prosper. And some of the other actors couldn't do it.
My daughter can't do it either.
Yeah,
she tries. She says, I can't do it.
I can do it with one hand and can't do it with the other. And I don't know if that means I'm starting to have a stroke or not. So they were creating on the set. And Nimoy was very worried about the ending, you know, whether Spock should play that final scene as big as he does, mm-hmm. where it's Jim, you're alive, so always doing, there were always many, many questions. Is this the right thing to do? And it's hit or miss. You don't know. Fortunately, their instincts were right 90% of the time. I don't know if you guys agree with 90%, but I feel 90%. And I think that is an episode that turned out very, very well in many ways. I really can't find much fault with it.
It's kind of interesting, the decision, like you were saying, to shoot that on stage and everything, because one of the things that we talked to with Dave Rossi, the visual effects producer for the remastered thing, was, you know, when they went back to try to redo the effects, he wanted to sort of fix the problem of there being no Vulcan landscape. It really was just sort of an empty red sky. What was that stuff like that, something which was addressed back then, or did they just feel that having a red sky would make it more alien than a than shooting something on location?
They loved putting clouds on the stage, but it was so much work. There was no computer-generated images back then. So the clouds that you see, for instance, in the episode Metamorphosis, which was shot on a stage, and Fetterman, Jerry Fetterman, decided he would always pick the color of the sky based on the mood of the script. And it was his idea to use color gels. He said, just give me a white psych. Don't even paint the walls. Make it a gigantic white psych and fill it in with dirt and everything else. And he said, I'll pick the color of the sky. I'll read the script and decide what the mood of this planet is based on the story and the theme. And so he did those beautiful magenta colors for Metamorphosis. But he wanted clouds. And director Ralph Sineski wanted clouds too. And so they took the time to create clouds in that episode, which he'd walk around with these little machines that would release puffs of smoke. And they would have to close all the doors and turn off all the fans, and everybody would have to stand very still so that these things would hang in the air long enough to be photographed. And they would have loved to have done that in probably every episode. But they just, you know, shooting episodes in 6 to 7 days, they couldn't. And when they did do clouds in an episode, it usually ran a day late just because of the clouds. So Amok Time took 7.5 days to film as it was. That fight scene took an entire day to shoot between Kirk and Spock. As a matter of fact, a day and a half. And so it was a big production for them as it was, and to try to put clouds in there just would have been impossible. But but the memos indicate that they, for that one, they felt a stark red sky would be great, because they just pictured, Roddenberry said it, he said, Vulcan has to be hot. He just felt that. It hadn't been established in the Bible, but other than the fact that we know that Spock liked to keep his quarters warm. But even that kind of came up in episodes after that. So this is the one that really established that that Vulcan, it was a very barren, hot place. And they just felt that that red sky worked.
I, as fans, you know, we're all really big fans of this episode, of course. You know, we think that this is one which is, you know, one of the best. But is that how the initial reaction was to the episode, and amongst both viewers and people working on the show?
Everyone liked it, except, you know how I put in some letters in most of these chapters that would come in the week after the episode would air? I think there's 3 or 4 letters, maybe even 5, for that particular episode that I included. And they're all good except for one. And one letter from this one woman, housewife, was very upset because she had teenage children, and they were home that night because high school football didn't start until the next week. So they actually caught that first episode on Friday nights. And she was just outraged that that scene where they talk about the salmon swimming upstream to spawn. And she said, you're doing an entire episode about this pointed-eared guy's sex drive, and my teenagers are watching this? Are you crazy? So, it was a different world, and it was shocking material for its time. I mean, very, very risque. And again, for 8:30 on a Friday night, NBC moved it there thinking, oh, we'll get all these young kids to watch it who couldn't stay up till 9:30 at night on Thursdays. Now they can watch it too. And NBC didn't think of the fact, or didn't care, that they were going to be losing the young adults and the high school students. But they knew they'd pick up the kids. And so what does Star Trek give them for the opening episode? NBC was behind it because they wanted to go to Vulcan. But they weren't too in love with the idea that it was about the sex drive of one of the characters, any more than they liked The Enemy Within in season 1 when Captain Kirk is trying to rape his yeoman. That's not quite the stuff NBC wanted to have on their entertainment schedule.
I guess it just depends on how you want to pitch it. Like, they pitched it as we go to Vulcan, not Spock's sex drive. I mean, had they pitched it as that, NBC wouldn't have gone for it.
That's right. And broadcast standards and practices at NBC always had a heart attack every week over the subject matter of these episodes and over the costumes that Bill Tice would come up with and the short mini skirts. This was America's first look at the mini when Star Trek premiered in 1966 and so forth. So it really alarmed them. So yeah, now, of course, 45 years later, we can look at a Muck Time and say, well, we need clouds in the sky, or would it be nice to see some mountains in the distance, or whatever. But, you know, if you look at it in context to when it was made, and you look at, they kind of created Stonehenge there with this blood red sky and these strange shaped symbols and gongs and the costumes and the rituals and the language and everything that they did, when you have to crank out 26 episodes a year, you know, and you're rewriting a dozen episodes simultaneously and shooting a new episode every 7 weeks, we got a bargain on that one, I think.
I am curious because when I talk to people, and I'm a big fan of Enterprise, and I know general fan base kind of likes to look down on Enterprise, but when it comes to Vulcans, I think if you go out on the street and you ask anyone to name a race from Star Trek, Vulcan is probably the first one that they'll say, or Klingon, one of those two, right? So the yeah. Vulcans are so famous in Star Trek, and yet in the original series, we have Spock. We don't see Vulcans very much outside of this one episode. TNG made a conscious effort to push the Vulcans to the side. And I'm doing a rewatch of DS9, and in one of the early episodes, I think it's Vortex. Anyway, there's a communication, and it's a Vulcan science ship. And I'm thinking, oh, they remembered that there are Vulcans in the Star Trek universe. And then when you get to Enterprise, of course, we actually get the story of the Vulcans, and we go back to Vulcan, and we learn so much about the planet. Why did they not revisit Vulcan as a planet at any point after this, really going through the original series? Why didn't we go back there? Why didn't we find out more about what's going on Spock's
they wanted
home
to.
World?
Yeah, they wanted to. And during the third season, they were actually looking, making an effort to look for a good reason, justification, a good story for going back. And they also were looking for a good reason to bring Sarek back during the third season. And mm-hmm. he was in one of the scripts as it was being developed. And they decided he wasn't being utilized enough, so they took him out. Not to lose him, but just to save him and utilize him better in a different story. So they were conscious of that, and they did want to use it. They just didn't find the story to do it. Plus, during the third season, the budget was so restrictive that it was very limiting to them to do that. But keep in mind that Star Trek went over budget every week. Only a handful. A very small handful of episodes were done on budget or a little under. It almost always went over budget. And so during the first season, Balance of Terror went over budget. And they couldn't afford to put Vulcan ears on all the Romulans, or Romulan ears, on pointed ears on all the Romulans. And that's why Bob Justman came up with the idea that most of the Romulans in the ship would be wearing helmets. And they did it again in the Enterprise incident for season three. Because the helmets they could afford, pointed ears they couldn't. They had to make those things. Fred Phillips had to stay up all night baking those ears in his oven at home so that Leonard Nimoy would have fresh ears the next morning. And if you had other characters with ears, that meant more ears you had to prepare. You couldn't just pick up a phone and order Vulcan ears like you can today. They had to be made from scratch. Everything was made from scratch. And so when you would go to a planet like this, NBC always wanted more planet shows. They didn't like the bottle shows. They didn't like the episodes that just took place on the Enterprise, even though some of the best episodes are bottle episodes, because it forced the characters to deal with themselves in the confinement of the ship, like Corbinite Maneuver, Balance of Terror, or the Doomsday Machine, or the Immunity Syndrome, and just fantastic episodes. But NBC wanted to see a new planet each week. But Star Trek couldn't afford to give them a new planet each week. You know, the budget for Star Trek was $195,000 for season one. It was dropped to $185,000 for season two and $178,000 for season three. Even though everybody was getting raises and inflation was causing the dollar to shrink each year, the budget got smaller and smaller. Now, you look at the later shows like Enterprise, you know, or Next Generation. Next Generation had a budget of $1.3 million per episode when it started, and it went up from there. So now it's common to spend anywhere from $2 to $3 million on a one-hour TV episode, where Star Trek was trying to do half a science fiction movie for $185,000, which would equate today to about $1.2 million. Well, $1.2 million is good money, but it's not $3 million, which is what they spend now. So it's they just couldn't afford it. That's the bottom line. They couldn't afford to go back to Vulcan.
So since Nimoy's contract was in question up until the very end, I'm assuming that there is a version of Amok Time which does not have Spock in it, which has this other character.
No, actually.
No? Okay.
Because they kept writing it in hopes that they were going to work the contract out, even though they didn't believe it. Gene Kuhn came back from vacation on April 1st and found a memo on his desk from Gene Roddenberry that said, "This is no April Fool's joke. It doesn't look like we're going to have Mr. Spock for season two. Negotiations have broken down. So we have to find another actor, and here's the short list of people that Joe DiAgosta and I came up with while you were on vacation for a week." Things would happen that quickly at Star Trek. You couldn't go away for a week and come back without major problems brewing on all fronts. So naturally, if they hadn't had Spock, they probably still would have made Amok Time, but they would have pushed it back further. So it could have involved their new Vulcan character, but they would have given us more time to get vested into that character. So they were pushing it back. I mean, they had that script ready to go first, but they just kept pushing it back until it was the fifth or sixth episode to shoot, I believe the fifth for season two. And so they were pulling other episodes forward, like Cat's Paw and Metamorphosis and Friday's Child and so forth, which they could have done just as easily with the alternate Vulcan who was going to take over Spock's job on the bridge. He wouldn't have been called Mr. Spock. He would have been called something else.
Do we know?
I would have to look at my notes to tell you, but it's in there, yeah.
Okay.
Starts with an S. It seems like every time, as a matter of fact, Bob Justman in one of his memos, the lover of Stom, I think he was called. The name that Theodore Sturgeon had for him the first time was something very close to it was Spore, S-P-O-R. And Bob Justman wrote a memo saying, considering the theme of this story, that this guy is T'Pring's lover. I think we're getting a little close to something here that we don't want to get close to. Why don't we just call him Sperm?
That's what I was thinking. But there would be an apostrophe in there. It would be S-P apostrophe E-R-M.
Mr. Sperm.
Mr. Sperm.
They kind of like those one-syllable names that were kind of hard-sounding names that started with an S.
Yeah, wasn't it in the making of Star Trek, the old one from the 60s, where they actually printed the memo where it was like three pages of Vulcan names, and they kept critiquing it back and forth, like you put the same name in there twice, and they're like...
Yep. I didn't print that memo because it was in the making of Star Trek. So I kind of figured we've all seen that memo, and I didn't want to take too much out of that book. But I saw that in the show files, absolutely, and it's a great, great memo. Must be 30 names on it, and just about every one of them starts with the letter S.
Well, the story about the replacement Vulcan is interesting to me because, like you said, maybe they would have done this story, but they would have pushed it so that we had time to kind of buy into this new character. Do you guys feel like that would have worked? Sometimes I feel like with a story, it's kind of out of the blue. I mean, if I really think about it, I guess it's fine for me, but the idea that suddenly no one knew that Spock had to bring.
Yeah. And nobody knew that Vulcans did this.
Right, that no one knew. I mean, yeah, at this point, and of course this is retconning having Enterprise under our belts, but the fact that, and having the movie First Contact under our belts as well, which of course is the benefit that we have that the viewers at that time didn't have. But the idea that humans and Vulcans had known each other for hundreds of years at this point, and all of this is some huge surprise to Kirk, is it's kind of surprising when we view the episode now. But not to get into that, I'm just wondering, like, do you guys feel like, would the story have worked for you if the replacement Vulcan had been there, and maybe this had been a season three story and we had a season with this character? Or is it just some, because it feels to me like a story that it works with Spock. I don't know if it, because it's not only that, it's the relationship between Spock and Kirk too that's important here.
No, it certainly would not have worked as well. And yeah. And neither would the new Vulcan have worked as well. Let's give them credit. I mean, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy really did great work with those characters.
Yeah.
And it's hard to follow them. It's hard to fill their shoes. You try to, and again, you look at the people that they almost hired to play Kirk. Well, first it was Jeffrey Hunter, you know, was going to be the captain. He did a creditable job in the cage, but he doesn't have the energy, the drive, the fire to really be the leader that would have kept that show alive every week. He had the right look, but not the right personality. He wasn't driven enough, because that character needs to be driven. He has to have a dark side as well. And so then Roddenberry tried to get Lloyd Bridges. That would have been a disaster. No offense to Mr. Bridges. He was great in swim trunks, but I wouldn't want to see him on Star Trek back at that time. And swim trunks meaning his show Sea Hunt, which is
right.
What he was famous for in the 60s. In case anybody wondered, why did Mark say that? what are we finding out about Mark right now? And then they wanted to get Jack Lord. And Lord agreed to do it, but he wanted too much money. And Gene Roddenberry quipped, Jack takes his last name too literally. Jack Lord went on and did 12 years on Hawaii 5-0 instead. You know, he was a very strong leading man, but he wouldn't have been as good as Shatner. So, and the same thing with Nimoy. You know, they wanted Martin Landau. They wanted a couple different people. And it's just Nimoy was the guy. And to put anybody else in that part, it wouldn't have been as good. I don't think we'd still be talking about Star Trek today if that had happened. And here's the really interesting thing, guys. The most unlikely party came forward and resolved the dispute and brought Nimoy back in. And again, I'm not going to tell you who. You've got to buy the book. But the most unlikely, you're welcome to guess, and if you guess right, I'll tell you. Just like if you guess who the guy was they signed to the contract, I'll tell you, you got it. Bingo. But I'm going to make you work if you want to know. You got to work for it. But the most unlikely party of all the parties that were involved in the making of Star Trek that had power and had clout and could say, do it, make it so. The most unlikely one was the one who resolved the situation. Much hints as I'm going to give you.
Was it George Takei?
Oh, my God, you guessed it. No. No. I don't have a buzzer. I'm sorry.
That one's tough. Now, who was going to be the other Vulcan? I mean, my guess is Lawrence Montaigne.
Bingo. That's a prize. Who was very, very unhappy. He gave me a tremendous interview. Yeah. He was very unhappy. As a matter of fact, he didn't even want to do a Muck Time. He refused. And Roddenberry threatened him. You'll never work in this town again.
You will take this guest spot, and you will like it.
Actually, but it's great that he didn't even want to do the episode, because I think it actually helped the episode, because that's how he needed to be in the episode, to stand there and be upset about the fact that Spock was going to get his girl. He's got to look pissed about it. Well, he didn't want to do the episode, so he looked pissed about it.
So there's so many layers to his acting. Yes. Right there. He wasn't just pretending that he didn't like Leonard Nimoy.
It's art imitating life. He's always second, whether it's in real life or in Star Trek continuity. He's always second to second to Spock.
He got the girl. He just didn't get the series.
Yeah. Well, you know, you win some, you lose some.
It's like in Deep Space Nine, you know, Alexander Siddig was he was not happy about the changes to Bashir's character in Dr. Bashir, I presume, them making him genetically enhanced, because it was a last-minute decision to make him genetically enhanced. He was really unhappy with the script, and if you watch the episode, I almost feel like you could see that a bit, that he's like, I don't like what they're doing to my character, but it actually helps the performance and it helps the episode.
Mm-hmm. That's my next episode, so
I'll look for that.
Right.
I want to respond to, I think was it Chris? I think you said it. That think it seemed a little fishy. You know, the salmon swimming upstream. But you think it was a little fishy that that Kirk wouldn't know about the sexual orientation of the Vulcans. But think about this: the way it was played out in the original Star Trek. If you can just limit yourself to thinking about that show, mm-hmm. forget about the other ones. We really had never met very many Vulcans, and the people in the Federation hadn't. Spock was the only Vulcan who was serving on a starship anywhere. We find out later in the Immunity Syndrome that there was a starship manned by only Vulcans. But this was the only situation where a Vulcan was actually interacting with humans, because Vulcans find humans just disgusting. They don't want to be around us, and they're certainly not going to tell us about their sex drives or their personal feelings, because they're so guarded. And they didn't. And I think Kirk even says in the episode that very rarely have humans been invited to go to Vulcan. That it was a rare situation for a human to be able to go there, other than maybe a couple ambassadors. And we know ambassadors and politicians never have sex, so they're not going to talk about that. So actually, I buy it. I totally buy it that they would not know very much about this. It's not like you're going to sit in a bar with a Vulcan and say, so tell me, how do you guys do it?
Well, it's like a salmon swimming upstream.
Exactly.
Barkeep, I'll have another.
Now, as Star Trek grew into the other series and they could afford to do the ears easier, we saw in more and more and more Vulcans, and humans are now interacting with Vulcans more. Yeah. And so this stuff's going to start coming out. But this is the first time. This is the first time we've met somebody from Russia. So we don't know what their customs are. We've never been there. I think you can equate it to that.
Yeah, I agree with you. If you look at only TOS, then no problem. It's as hard as fans these days to look at it that way.
It's difficult. And one of my jobs in these books was to do that, was to try to shove you guys, kicking and screaming, try to shove you into a time machine and take you back there. And that's why I'll mention what song's playing on the radio and what the news story is and everything else. I'm not trying to be Casey Kasem or anybody like that. But what I'm trying to do is remind you of what's happening in the world and how different it is than it is now, so that you can appreciate what they're trying to do on that show and what their obstacles are. So, yeah, there was a real mystique about the Vulcans, I buy it. I'm easy.
Well, are there any final points about anything that you uncovered in the discussions internally and the memos, anything that the actors felt about the episode that you want to throw out there?
They all loved it. It was one where nobody on the staff or nobody at the network, nobody at the studio, nobody in the cast seemed to have anything negative to say about that one. Because it was, as a matter of fact, Shatner, there's a quote from him in there where he was just so marveled by the risque elements of the material and that they were actually going to get away with doing that on TV back then. So you're right on the cutting edge. You're doing things nobody's ever done before. And there's got to be a great feeling of satisfaction when you can do something like that. So you're not noticing if the set could be a little better or whatever. You're going, my God, we're getting away with this on NBC on Friday nights at 8:30. So that's just kind of is the feeling everybody walked away with, and they felt very good about opening the year with that episode. The end.
Mike and Drew, do you guys have any final questions about Amok Time?
No, I don't think so. Yeah,
that's very interesting to see, to hear the inside thoughts of the writers and the actors. And
well, you know something else, guys? You know, by watching them in the order that they're made, is you'll notice things like this too. Which episodes have new music in them, and which ones have track music? And that one had an all new score, and that had the Vulcan march theme in there, which was then used in a lot of other episodes during fight sequences and so forth.
And a lot of other TV shows and movies as well over the years.
And the Vulcan the Spock's theme. That was written, that was played on a bass guitar, kind of clunking the notes out, because it would be an awkward piece of music to fit his character and the internal conflict that's always going on with his character. And so they were all very happy about that, too. So anyway, I'll shut up now so you can wrap this up.
No, it's really, very fascinating look. And, of course, in the book, everyone can find out much, much more about this episode and all the others. And I'm actually glad we're able to stretch beyond this episode today and even talk about, of course, Spock's brain. Thank you, Landru. And season three, because it does all fit together. What I find interesting about the original series as compared to the later series is the fact that you're right, Mark, that if you watch them in production order, you do see the evolution of the characters, how the actors portray them and the music and such. But compared to the other series, TOS is a series where, for me anyway, it feels like, with the exception of some of the very, very, very first produced episodes in season one, you can almost just watch the episodes in random order from all three seasons, and it's not obvious to you which season they come from, unless you know the series so well that you know about the budget constraints and you can, you know, pick out things that are going on. Whereas, like, if you do that with TNG, it's really obvious this is a sixth or a seventh season episode versus this is a first or a second season episode.
Yeah, it's obvious to me because I was there watching them as a kid, and so they get burned in your brain. And Shatner's hair would get a little longer each year as hair fashions got longer, and the shirts in the third season were different, and things of that nature. And the photography was just a smidge brighter in the third season. I preferred the darker approach of season one and two. So, but you have to really know the show. You're absolutely right. Otherwise, and by the way, that's the way they wanted it, is back in those days, everything was standalone. You didn't have to watch the entire series of Breaking Bad, great show, by the way, but you didn't have to watch the whole thing in proper order to follow the story and think, oh my, what did we miss last week? I'm lost now, you know? Each episode was a standalone. And so they loved it, even when you watch shows like Gilligan's Island, God forbid, or I loved that one as a kid anyway. I should say God forbid. And I think we all did, let's admit it. And he always had the same red shirt. The skipper always had the same blue shirt. And everybody on Bonanza always wore the same clothes. Nobody ever changed their clothes. They must have stunk like hell. But the reason was is that every episode looked like every other episode. So you immediately knew what the show was when you were flipping channels. Oh, there's Bonanza, or there's Star Trek, or there's this. And if they had to go pick up a shot a few weeks later because they're editing something they shot a month before and suddenly they realize they don't have a close-up of somebody, they could go in and grab a close-up and not have to worry about changing their clothes. And that's why they experimented now and then with Kirk having a different top, and then they would abandon it. Because whenever they wanted to go do a pickup shot, it was like, oh, God, we got to go get that other shirt. And it was much easier if everybody's just wearing the same clothes. Mm-hmm. So TV was such a sausage factory back then. You know, you had to crank those episodes out so quickly that the easiest way to do it was just make them very uniform. And that's why you can't tell the difference between seasons 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. Where with shows that are done today, they can. You watch Breaking Bad, my God, Bryan Cranston, he changes so much through the course of that series. You almost know what season it is by how bad he looks.
All right. Well, so this is a season two episode, and you said the book for season two is going to be dropping on March 1st, correct?
Yeah. Now, when this airs, which is like in 5 minutes, because I know you guys do these almost live. We delay them just slightly, so in case I use any profanity.
That's right, yeah. You have
or if my dogs start barking.
A three-day delay. It's a little longer than television.
The book won't be available yet. It'll still be a month away, or a few weeks anyway. But I got to put in a plug here. You got that revised and expanded version of book one, which has 80 additional pages, twice as many photographs, bigger photographs. And the reason we did it, besides just wanting to tidy it up a bit, and I wanted a better cover. I didn't like the cover. But Leonard Nimoy called me to congratulate me on the book. And he had not been willing to be interviewed because he said everything he has to say about Star Trek, or he thought. And he read the book and got in touch with me and said, John Chambers always took credit for the ears. And you've quoted him in there, as you should, and that's fine. But he didn't come up with the ears. And so he told me, I was groping for a recorder, and can I tape this? And he said, sure, sure. And it was like, get the tape rolling, or digital, actually. Nothing's rolling. But you know what I mean. And I get it going, and he told me the whole story, the whole process of the ears and a few other things that had never been told before, had never been clarified before. And it's because he read the book. And he loved it because there was so much information in there that he really felt it took him back. And it got him to start remembering things that he hadn't remembered and hadn't remembered to include in his books. And so he gave me a lot of great information. And Gene Kuhn's secretary, Andy Richardson, called me from Australia. And I'd been searching for her. And it's like, well, we can't talk to Gene Kuhn, but we can talk to his secretary. And I found something out, and I put it in the revised version of book one. You ready for a scoop?
Yeah, let's hear it.
I know you're going to have to really cut this show down now. But they always called him, and Bob Justman called him, the fastest typewriter in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Kuhn could write a script in a weekend. He wrote Devil in the Dark in a couple days. He wrote Arena in just a couple days and all that kind of stuff. You know how he did it?
His secretary?
Speed.
Oh, well, that's cool.
Oh.
he liked uppers. And I said, are you okay with me putting that in the book? And she said, sure. Not like he was an addict or anything, but when he had a script done in 2 days, he'd tell me to go get him some pills.
Well, it's just like
the job of a secretary in the 60s.
Today it would be just get me a case of Red Bull. So
it would be hard in the 60s. Just walk out of the street on Sunset and you can get some. I just say he'd smoke his cigarettes, he'd take some speed, and he'd be writing, his fingers would be flying over those typewriter keys.
Wow.
And you want to talk typos. Hey, I took a peek here. You should read Gene Kuhn's draft of Arena. My God.
Is that where they got the name Kirok?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a typo.
Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be Kirok. It's just typo. Yeah.
And now I guess the other great thing about this expanded version is it's now available worldwide, right?
It's all over the planet. And it's in 8 different languages. You can get it in hardback, paperback, or Kindle. And I asked them to lower the price because I said, look, some of the people who bought the book when it first came out, and there's only 3,000 of them. There's just 3,000 copies of that first edition.
Andrew's one of those people. I see a tear running down his face right now.
Me too.
I thought they might feel ripped off if they have to buy it again. So don't charge them $40, for God's sakes. And so they're selling it for $25. And if you contact the publisher, if you go to the publisher's website, and they just built a special one, so you don't have to remember their name, just go to theseofthevoyagesbooks.com. And you can contact them. There's a contact button. And if you tell them you already bought the first book, and they'll know, don't lie to them, they'll sell it to you for less than that $25.
Oh, cool.
They're really being stand-up about this. And so you get 80 additional pages, a better cover, it's been proofed, all those wonderful things, and it ain't going to cost you hardly anything. And don't throw away your original, and don't sell it on Amazon for $5, and I'll tell you why. There's somebody out there, Miles of Movies from the East Coast, that's trying to sell a copy for $130. There's only 3,000 of those. they're going to be worth something. You'll see those things on eBay in a few years. You watch. You'll kick yourself if you throw that thing away. Hang on to it.
Plus, if you leave the little piece of Plomeek bubblegum in its wrapper in the middle of the book, it'll be worth even more.
There you go. Now you're really going to get something.
But seriously, if you're an original series fan, I mean, you really can't spend $25 on anything better. It's an awesome book.
Thank you very much. I thought you were going to say if you're an original series fan, you're on a fixed income and Social Security.
I was wondering where that was going too.
You can't afford it.
All right, Mark. Well, that's where people can go to find out about the book.
And you know what else? You get it autographed, and not only have I autographed it, and Susan Osborne, who was my helper, but Mr. John D.F. Black, the sole surviving producer from the very first Star Trek. He has a business card that says, John D.F. Black, sole surviving producer from the first Star Trek series. So he doesn't mind. he's autographed them too. So for $25, less if you tell him you bought it originally, you're going to get a brand spanking new book that's bigger than the first book, has that Leonard Nimoy interview I told you about, Pete Sloman's interview, Andy Richardson's interview, all that stuff. And John, forget my signature. You can get that for nothing. But John D.F. Black, good God. You know, I think I'm going to buy one.
Excellent.
And you can't get that from Amazon. You can buy the book there, but you can't get the signatures.
That's right.
So there you go. There's the plug.
Well, Mark, what if people want to find you personally and other things you're working on? Where should they go?
Yeah, you can go to markcushman.com. I have my own website. I'm kind of a showbiz guy. You got to have your own website. You guys have your own websites. I got to have mine. So you can go there and you can see what I'm up to, and you can see where and you can also read about it at theseofthevoyagesbooks.com. They'll tell you where, if I'm going to be doing a signing somewhere. For people who live in the Los Angeles area, John D.F. Black and Mary Black and me will be at, believe it or not, the Burbank Library called us. And we all live near Burbank, just minutes away. So, and that's good because we don't like to drive very far, you know. So they called and said, would you come down and we want to do a screening of The Naked Time and then do a Q&A panel with you guys afterwards. And so we're going to do that on January 30th. It's a Thursday. And the screening is going to be at 6 o'clock at night, and then there'll be a little break afterwards. And then we're going to do a Q&A. And I think bring your book, and John will sign it if you didn't get a signed one. So if anyone who's in the L.A. area, that'll be January 30th, Thursday, in Burbank, at the Buena Vista branch in Burbank. Buena Vista is a street in Burbank. That's right near the Disney studio. That's why the Disney studio is Buena Vista Productions. Mm.
That's awesome.
There, you learned something new.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Just beam over and I'll see you there.
Excellent. Too bad I'm not there. I would definitely drop by for that. All right. Well, Mark, thanks so much for sharing the background of A Mock Time with us today. Really appreciate your time.
You betcha.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking to Mark Cushman about A Mock Time. It's great to hear some behind-the-scenes info on what went down with one of my favorite episodes.
Definitely, and we really jumped all over the place there too, didn't we? Got a little Spock's brain in there, got all kinds of stuff going on. And I'm telling you, Mark has to come back when season 3 of the book series comes out to do a Spock's brain show.
Oh yeah, can't wait for that one.
Absolutely. That is a must. Well, again, thanks so much to Mark for taking some time for us here today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this past week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
A piece of the action commentary.
Wouldn't that be amazing if you went to a solar system and Spock was like, okay, Kirk, you're not going to believe this, but I'm pretty sure there's a Death Star here.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could just go to a Death Star, you know?
And he'd be like, no, there isn't. Holy cow, there is. Oh my God, that's awesome.
Earl Grey.
TNG Season 1 Recap.
And we get to see some junior officers that Lieutenant LaForge is now in command of.
Instant pep talk and miss I don't know what button to push.
That's what happens when you leave the entire senior crew off.
The Ready Room.
Affliction and Divergence.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about that, though, is to compare the Klingon ethics with the Section 31 ethics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, there are some groups within the Klingons who maybe don't feel exactly the same way. But then there's this group within the humans who feels completely different. And you kind of wonder what the Klingons think maybe about someone who wouldn't do this.
The orb.
Implications of genetic enhancement.
Miles slowly kind of gets to know these other characters. He's a little bit more comfortable with him, but he's still kind of at arm's length because they don't have that normal sense of control, what we would call normal sense of control, that Julian does.
To the journey!
The Borg.
Some people might really get on my case for saying this, but I think the Borg were bigger baddies and more threatening and more scary in TNG than they ever were on Voyager.
Warp 5.
Enterprise Season 3 with Larry Nemechek.
All of a sudden, UPN got put under Les Moonves, the head honcho of CBS, the master TV network dealmaker, and kind of looked at this thing, and he was not all caught up in the goldenness of the 90s and the aughts, and he's like, you guys aren't paying your own way.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Alphas.
Those TV shows were nerds, and nerds liked those TV shows because like of what they were, and Alphas was actually a pretty cool nerd, and people didn't seem to like it. Because it was just a little bit too tough-looking. Like, it maybe knows how to throw a football.
Literary Treks.
Slings and arrows, the oppressor's wrong.
And I'm curious to see, the next time I go back and watch Homefront Paradise Lost, how much this adds to the experience for me, knowing all this stuff that was going on, and knowing how much more involved Layton's plans were than what we knew about just from the episodes.
Matter Stream.
Star Trek Axanar with Alec Peters and Richard Hatch.
If you've ever experienced war or any kind of conflict where everything is life and death, there's a certain kind of resolve, truth, experience that you come to that I don't think too many people can understand or ever really empathize with.
And introducing our newest show, Melodic Treks, covering the music of Star Trek.
Alexander Courage and the TOS theme.
Roddenberry, in fact, wrote words for Courage's Star Trek theme song, not because he expected the lyrics to be sung on television or anything like that, but just so that by doing he could claim credit as the song's co-creator and therefore receive half the royalties from the song.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. And some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream or download from the website. And you'll find links to everything over at trek.fm/pd for podcast directory. So download the shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And Mike, if people want to share their thoughts on Amok Time or Season 2 or anything we talked about today, if they want to agree with us that William Shatner is the best person ever, there are a variety of ways that you can do that. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about this show and anything you want to talk about in the world of Star Trek. Again, that's at trek.fm/forums. And I'd also like to remind everyone about Questions from the Fleet. If you have any questions about Star Trek that you'd like us to answer and discuss here on the show, just hop over to trek.fm/contact again, the same page, but there's an option there for Questions from the Fleet for the Ready Room. And choose that and send us your questions, and we will discuss them during the news segment. So we look forward to finding out what you would like to know about Star Trek. And social media, you can find us in a couple of places. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You'll also find us on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username TrekFM. Now, Mike, when you're not trying to figure out the best way to get out of a fight with a Vulcan, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me here on Trek FM with Drew doing Standard Orbit, where we talk about the original series. Or you can find me here on Trek FM with my co-host Max doing Commentary Trek Stars, where we talk about the people who work on Star Trek, but what they've done outside of Star Trek. Right now, we're just wrapping up our Ira Stephen Bear series, so you can check that out. Or you can find me and Max, along with our co-host Brandon, talking about whatever we want to talk about on Commentary Track Stars Off Topic, which you can find on commentarytrackstars.com. Excellent. Or you can find me on Twitter at ComTrackStars.
That's right, yeah. It's a ComTrack. It's
hopefully
one of those.
ComFrack pretty soon.
I like that idea. Yeah. ComFrack Stars.
Commentary Frack Stars. The Battlestar Galactica podcast.
Excellent. I like it. I like it a lot. All right. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my own personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, you'll find me on too many shows. There's Literary Treks, which I do with Matthew Rushing. We talk Star Trek books and comics on that show, and we interview authors. This coming week, we're going to be talking to Dayton to wrap up our series of interviews related to The Fall, the big Star Trek novel series that has been coming out here in the fall of 2013. And we've had every author on, all five authors. So if you're reading those books, be sure to go over to Literary Treks to hear firsthand from the authors the story behind the books. Also, Matthew and I do The Orb together, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. You'll find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And then I also have my own interview show, Matterstream, where I talk to scientists and writers and actors and all sorts of creative people about things that are loosely related to or inspired by Star Trek. And the episode that just dropped this week is a really interesting one. I have Alec Peters, who is the founder of PropWorks and was the keeper of all the Star Trek artifacts for CBS for a while as well. And also Richard Hatch from Battlestar Galactica, who everyone knows as Apollo, and then Tom Zarek in the most recent version. And we talked about their project Star Trek Axanar, which is a very interesting take on the Star Trek universe. And you can find out all about it by just going and listening to that show as well. Again, that's on Matterstream. So check out all of those shows if you're interested. Before we go, I'd also like to ask you to please support our sponsor for this week's show. They make it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you and all of our shows to you every week. And again, our sponsor this week is Audible.com, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from. There are new titles every week. You can pick up any of those great Shatner books that we talked about, new Star Trek Memories, Star Trek Movie Memories, Shatner Rules, or non-Star Trek books that you like as well. Maybe your favorite current release or bestseller in audio format. Just go over to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. And we really thank Audible for supporting the Ready Room and the network. And lastly, there is one more way you can directly help us. You can get some aliens. We have original alien illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. They're available both as badges and as art prints, and you can mix and match, choose which ones you want in which formats. We have different levels of contributions for you to choose from as well, and your donations help us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the Ready Room to you every week. So we really thank you for helping us keep the network going. All right, Mike. Well, there is another show. I'm going to wander off and see if Tapreen is busy because, I think I can take Stein.
All right. Well, in that case, I think it's time to stick Lawrence Montaigne in it because the Ready Room is done.
As time goes by, you might find that having never satisfies like the one in your mind. It's not logical, I know, but it's true, and now I go to live with what I've sacrificed.
William Shatner's best pants ever.